Welcome to the 255th episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Winograd. I'm your host, Randy Winograd. In this edition of the podcast, our topics are an overview of Patrick's weekend predictions, our weekly look at NBA action, our weekly look at Major League Baseball, and our review of the women's and men's basketball Final Four. Let's jump right in with a look back at Patrick's weekend predictions, which are posted every Thursday on our website, 4thand24.com. And we will start with the men's and women's Final Four, where Patrick went 4-0 in his weekend predictions. Similarly, in the NBA, Patrick went 4-0 with his weekend predictions. And with his first weekend series predictions in Major League Baseball, Patrick went 3-1. That means he went 11-1 this week. Terrific week, bringing him to an overall record of 1,035-670. That's a 60.7% winning percentage. Patrick, your thoughts on your weekend predictions?
Well, I had a few bad weeks in a row for the few weeks before this, so I needed to get back on the right track, and I think I did that this week. Sometimes the MLB is not as predictable as one would like it to be, but I think, you know, when the pitching matchups line up either favorably or just evenly with the better team, or at least the better team in my opinion, I think it becomes easier to predict. It's always harder when the pitching matchups might favor a team that's slightly worse than the team they're playing. And then, you know, you got to pick, do you like the matchups or do you like the team? But this week was pretty simple. And I guess I'll start there because I talked about it. But the Braves swept the Diamondbacks. A few comebacks in that series by the Braves. So the Diamondbacks did hang in there, but they blew a few games there, and the Braves ended up taking that one, which I picked correctly. The Giants took 2 of 3 from the Padres. Also a few chokes in that game. The Padres were up in a few of those games and lost. I predicted that right. The Yankees took 2 of 3 from the Blue Jays, which I predicted correctly. Yankees lost that first game of that series, and then the other games they were pretty much dominating throughout, just with strong offensive performances. And the one I got wrong was that the Brewers took 2 of 3 from the Mariners. I picked the Mariners. That was one where I went with pitching matchups, and I was wrong. But the Brewers, starting off the year pretty well after a lot of people were down on them, considering they lost two of their big three and on the starting pitching staff. So people doubting them heading into the season, and they're doing pretty well to start it off. But 3-1 overall in MLB is pretty good. Then I'll go to the NBA. The Celtics beat the Kings 101-100, a very, very close game. The Kings definitely had more to play for than the Celtics do at this point, but it was the Celtics who ended up coming up with that victory nonetheless. Then you have the Pacers who beat the Thunder 126-112. A lot of these picks were just out of sheer motivation. I picked a lower seeded team in every single game except for the Kings and the Celtics, just because the separation's a little bit too big there. But the Pacers came out on fire. They needed to win a lot more than the Thunder did. The Thunder really only fighting for the one seed, and at worst, they'll be the three seed. Whereas the Pacers are fighting to, at least at that point, were fighting to make sure they didn't end up in the play-in, and could end up, I think, as high as third or even second, depending on what happens in the rest of the season. The East is crazy, so we'll talk about that part later. But then the Mavs beat the Warriors 108-106. They did play earlier in the week, and the Warriors won that matchup. But this one, really close one. The Mavs got out to a hot start, and at the end of the game, it just wasn't quite enough for the Warriors to come back. And then the Suns beat the Timberwolves 97-87. The Suns have been playing better recently. They needed to, but they definitely have stepped it up recently. And the Timberwolves, not so much, but I think they're still just battling for the one seed, which, again, I don't think it's as important as it is for those teams that are fighting for their playoff lives, especially the teams that maybe are more talented. When you look at a team like the Suns, who have the potential to be a contender, and I think, I don't know for sure, but I think probably are still up there in odds with teams like the Timberwolves, even if their record doesn't show it, just because of the star power they have on their roster and their experience. But then in Final Four predictions, I predicted the semis in both the women's and the men's. I got all those right. South Carolina beat NC State 78-59. That was a win. I got Iowa beating UConn 71-69. That was a win. I had Purdue beating NC State 63-50. That was a win. And I had UConn beating Alabama, which happened 86-72. That was also a win. Won't talk about them in depth now because that's our whole segment later, other than the championship game. So just brushing over those very, very quickly. But I did go 4-0 in those basketball predictions, and sad to say goodbye to the college basketball season. No more predictions there for me, and well, no more content there for me, unless I release a way too early top 25 or way too early bracket. But I don't really like those things, so I probably won't do that.
Yeah, and those things are really way too early, especially in this era of the transfer portal. All right, well, Patrick's predictions for next weekend, hopefully for his sake, will be as good as this weekend's, but they will definitely be posted on our website, 4th and24.com, on Thursday, as always. So let's now turn our attention to the NBA. And speaking of as always, let's start with the most impressive teams of last week.
Well, this team has been on the opposite end of this list a lot this week, this year. That's the 76ers. They went 4-0 this week. They beat San Antonio, Memphis, Miami, and OKC. They've surged recently with 5 wins in a row. Unfortunately, if you look at the standings, that was after a very, very long skid. And Philly is still one game behind Indy for the 6th seed. So they are currently in the play-in after, you know, they were supposed to be part of the big three in the East of teams, and just all season long were expected to do great things, but haven't because of injuries. They do have Detroit and Brooklyn on their schedule, though. And with Embiid potentially back, they should win those two easily and have a chance to beat Orlando to finish the season 3-0. And if they did that, their seeding would actually still be in the hands of Indy, obviously, because, and actually multiple teams ahead of them. But it would be definitely very, very helpful if they could go 3-0 to close out the season, end up with 47 wins. That is a number that none of the teams seeded 3rd through 6th have gotten yet. So I guess technically it's possible Philly could climb all the way to the 3. But I don't see that happening. I don't see all the other teams going winless. But at the same time, they do need to stack some wins up and hopefully get out of the play-in bracket. But they would be a tough, I mean, that would be a tough matchup for the Bucks, honestly, in the first round to draw the Sixers if they were to win the first game of the play-in. With the Bucks as the 2 seed, although the Bucks might not even get the 2 seed at this rate. So we'll talk about that in a second. But the Mavericks, they went 3-1 this week. They beat Houston, Golden State, and Atlanta. They lost to Golden State earlier in the week. The next two teams, including this one, have something in common. The only thing that beat them last week was each other. Dallas is 9-1 in its last 10. And after a crazy overtime win against Houston, they look really, really good heading into the playoffs. They're currently in 5th with 2 games remaining, with 2 games in the standing separating them from both the Clippers at number 4 and the Suns at number 6 on either side of them. So it's looking really likely that they're already locked into their seed in the 5 seed, and it looks like we're going to see Clippers Mavs again in the postseason, which we've seen a lot recently. But this time it'll have Kyrie and James Harden in the mix as new additions to that playoff rivalry, with Luka and Kawhi still going at it as they have for many years now. And then you have the Warriors, who they have a chance to rekindle a rivalry that we'll talk about in a second. But they went 3-1 this week. They beat Utah, they beat Houston, they beat Dallas, and then they lost to Dallas. It could be too little too late for them, though, just like the Sixers. They did eliminate Houston from playoff contention earlier in the week, and they stopped that skid that they were on that almost allowed Houston to kind of backdoor into the playoffs. But they are still 1.5 games back behind the Lakers and 2 behind Sacramento with only 4 games remaining. They would have to go on a ridiculous run at the end of the season to even get to the 8th seed, which is not a high bar considering that franchise's expectations. It's looking like there will be a likely playoff rematch either in the 9-10 play-in. It will be in the 9-10 play-in with the Warriors and somebody. It's just about if it's between the Warriors and the Kings, which was an exciting first round series last year, or if it's a rematch with the Lakers, who have obviously played them in the play-in in the past. That would be an interesting rematch. And they also played them in the postseason last year. But I think Golden State would rather play the Kings again. But the West has been as wild as advertised all season long, and the ending looks like it'll be no different. And speaking of the Lakers, they went 3-1 this week. They beat Cleveland, Washington, and Toronto. They lost to Minnesota. It's a great sign heading into the playoffs that the Lakers only had 1 loss this week, and it was with LeBron out for the game and with AD leaving in the middle of the game with an injury, although, of course, that happens too often, but it is what it is. After going 8-2 in their last 10, the Lakers enter the last week of the season a half of a game back of Sacramento for the 8th seed, which is obviously a big difference in seeding, as if you're the 8th seed, you know, you go on the road, you play New Orleans, you win that game, and you're in the playoffs. But if you're the 9th seed, you have to both beat whoever the 10 seed is, which in this case would be Golden State, and then also play the next game against the loser of that first play-in game. So big difference between 8 and 9 seed there. So it'll be a tough road for the Lakers that likely goes through the play-in, but they definitely do have the star power to deal with it. So we'll see what happens at the end of the season, but the West is crazy.
All right, now let's turn our attention to the least impressive teams of last week.
Well, I had the honor. Is it an honor? I don't know. I saw this team in person. They're terrible. The Bucks, they went 0-4. They lost to New York. They lost to Toronto. They lost to Memphis. They lost to Washington. Yes, I read that right. This might have been the worst in-season coaching change I've seen in my entire life. This team has barely been staying afloat for the latter half of the season. I believe they have a losing record now with Doc Rivers, which is just insane that you have a team with Giannis Antetokounmpo and Damian Lillard and Chris Middleton. I could go on. And you have a losing record as a team over any stretch of the season that's not like, you know, some random 10-game slump. But at this point, at some point, it was Boston and then Milwaukee a little bit behind them and then everybody else in the Eastern Conference standings. Now it's Boston, a 15-game gap, and then Milwaukee has two teams within a game of them, Orlando and New York, and another team 1.5 games back that could put them as the road team in a first-round series, that team being Cleveland, of course. So this is just, I mean, this is just really, really dangerous, the game that Milwaukee's playing. It's just an unthinkable downfall. But of course, they still do have the players to make a deep run. I just don't see it happening because they have, I mean, at some point when it's this late in the year, you're going to start playing like you have the players to make a deep run. And they are one of the only teams who hasn't. Even the Sixers have overcome some of their injuries and started playing better. The Clippers have started to play better after their little mini slump. The Mavericks are playing way better. The Suns are playing way better. Everybody's playing better except for the Bucks. So it's just really, really bad what's going on in Milwaukee. And if you're looking for a first round upset pick, tell me what the matchup is, and I'll probably say I'm picking against the Bucks. A very, very likely first round exit. If you're trying to figure out which of the higher ranked seeds would lose in the first round, then you have the Cavs. They went 1-3. This is really just a missed opportunity for them. They lost to the Lakers, the Clippers, and Phoenix. They beat Utah. They had an opportunity to make up some serious ground in the East, and they actually lost ground this week. They could have ended the week as the 2 seed given Milwaukee struggles, but instead they're 5th heading into the last 3 games. They play 6-seeded Indy, and if they win that one, they have games against Memphis and Charlotte, so it should be an easy 2-1 record there with a chance to go 3-0 to end the season and maybe claim a better playoff seed. But, you know, there's also the chance that Indy beats them, goes undefeated themselves, and the Cavs end up as the 6th. But, you know, who knows what the matchups are going to be when all those teams are within like a game or two of each other anyway. So it's kind of really hard to judge which seed is the best one to fall into. But then you have the Thunder. They went 1-3 this week. They lost to Philly, Boston, and Indy, and they beat Charlotte again. This is just not what you want to see from a top-level team. They are fighting for the 1 seed. Like I said, maybe a lack of motivation, but look, barely scraping out 1 win against Charlotte over the course of a week is not something that any team of that caliber should be doing. And they now find themselves 1 game back of both Denver and Minnesota for home court in the West. They play Sacramento and Dallas, who are both fighting hard for playoff spots, and also Milwaukee, who will be fighting for seeding. So other than their game against the pesky Spurs, who even took the Sixers to overtime this weekend, OKC does have a tough road trying to make up ground and claim home court. I don't see it happening. We'll see what that matchup ends up as if they are the 3 seed. Right now it would be the Suns, which would be a tricky matchup for OKC. And also it would be an interesting one because it would be Kevin Durant playing at OKC. That would be very, very entertaining. But then you have the Pelicans. They are the 4th team on here. They went 1-2, lost to San Antonio and Orlando, beat Phoenix. The Pelicans have played themselves right into the play-in bracket, and I don't mean that in a good way. Their 4-6 record in their last 10, juxtaposed with Dallas going 9-1 and Phoenix going 7-3, means that Phoenix and New Orleans are now tied for the 6th seed, currently with the Kings 1 back and the Lakers 1.5 back. That is not where you want to be this late into the season, and the Pelicans play the Blazers first, but then end the season with 3 games in 4 days against every other play-in team. They play all of Sacramento, Golden State, and the Lakers. It'll be a really, really tough road for New Orleans, and they could easily end up in the 9-10 game after that. Would not have seemed plausible earlier in the season. It would be very hard for them to end up. They're not going to end up as the 10 seed, but it is definitely possible that both the Lakers and the Kings beat them, and they do end up as the 9 with the Lakers and the Kings claiming the 7 and the 8. I wouldn't be surprised. So just a bad end to the season for the Pelicans.
Okay, that wraps up our look at the NBA for this week. Let's now turn our attention to Major League Baseball with a review of the first few weeks of action in the MLB.
Yep, starting in the American League, we'll start in the AL East. You have the Yankees at the top of the standings at 9-2, Boston at 7-3 in second, Baltimore at 5-4 in third, Toronto and Tampa Bay tied at the bottom at 5-6. I won't have too much commentary about this because obviously the season just started, but look, the Yankees, they've come out and they've done exactly what they were supposed to do. Arguably a little bit better considering that Gerrit Cole went down with his injury and we don't know his status, although he will be out for an extended period of time. Just don't know how long. But look, 9-2, I think they have the best record in baseball, which is something that, you know, heading into the season, that was, they're actually tied with another team that we'll talk about later for best record in baseball. That really shows you that 11 games is not enough of a good, is not a good enough sample to judge baseball. But anyway, we still got to talk about it. So the Yankees having a good start to the season. I'm liking what I'm seeing from them offensively. They've had guys stepping up. Anthony Volpe's had a pretty good start to the season after, or at least he's made some impact plays that, you know, he maybe wasn't making early on last year. Juan Soto and Aaron Judge have been as advertised, and the pitching staff's been pretty good as well. Then you go down to the second part of the standings and you see Boston there and you go, wait a minute, how did that happen? Okay. I do have to say there's an extreme caveat on this team being 7-3. They have played maybe not the weakest schedule in the league, but they've definitely played some subpar teams, let's just say, to start the season. They do have a series coming up against third place Baltimore here in a second, but they did start the season, you know, on the road against the Mariners. Okay, that's a tough series. They split that one. But then they played the A's and the Angels. So, I mean, do they deserve credit for taking 5 of 6? I'd say they deserve some credit, but at the same time, they split a series with the Mariners, who are 4-7 on the season. And then they just beat up on the A's and the Angels. So they beat up on the worst division in baseball. Maybe not the worst division in baseball, but the two teams who are at least in the bottom five or bottom six of the league. When you look at the Angels and the A's. So I don't want to give Boston too much credit for that, but at the same time, they're still going to take any wins they can get. You need to take care of business when you're not playing teams in the AL East because of how hard this, how good this division is. So they still do deserve some credit for, as I would say, for an NBA team taking care of business. And then you have Baltimore 5-4. Nothing crazy about their start to the season. They've played an average schedule. I'd say, I guess I'm kind of disappointed, but at the same time, the difference between 5-4 and 6-3 is so big, but at the same time, it's only one game. So it's hard to say at this point in the season that there are any overall takeaways, but so far Baltimore's played all right. And they'll figure it out as the season goes on. They lost some close games, some extra innings games, especially against Pittsburgh over the weekend. So they'll figure it out. It'll be fine. But they do play Boston this week, which is a good measuring stick series for both of those teams. Then you have Toronto and Tampa Bay, who both went 5-6. Not going to lie, I haven't watched many of these either of these teams too much. Haven't paid that much attention. I know they played each other to start the season, but you know, one game under 500. Technically, yeah, they're one game under 500. It is what it is. It's early in the season. Again, hard to evaluate these teams this early on. The one thing I will say is that Tampa Bay having Zach Eflin come out and just not be good at all to start the year is a really bad sign for them. Their pitching staff has been way more inconsistent than it normally is. Ryan Pepiot had a terrible start in his first start, then somehow pitched a gem in Coors Field. So they've just been all over the place. For Toronto, there are some concerns about Kevin Gausman throwing really low velocity on his fastball in their game, which with all the dead arms floating around and all the Tommy John surgeries going around, you don't like to hear that early in the season. So that's not a good sign either. But then going to the Central, where the a contender for the worst team in baseball is housed, and potentially the worst division, but you know, maybe it's played a little better. I guess technically a surprise at the top with the Guardians at 8-2. More surprised they're doing this well and pitching this dominant. They've only given up 21 runs in 10 games. That is an average of 2.1 runs against. Yes, that is correct math. They destroyed the Twins in a head-to-head series, who are the divisional favorites here. And then you have Kansas City. They are 6-4. They've won four in a row. The Tigers are 6-4, but they've done the opposite of Kansas City. They've lost three in a row. They had a great start to the season, haven't been good since because they've played some harder teams. Then you have Minnesota at 3-5, who have lost three in a row, currently playing the Dodgers. That's not going to help. And of course, that bottom team that I was talking about are the Chicago White Sox. They are terrible, 1-9. Fangraphs has already given them a 0.0% chance to make the playoffs, which is really early in the season to already be given no chance to even make the playoffs, let alone do anything in the playoffs. Then in the West, you have the Rangers, who are at the top at 6-4. They've had a good start to the season offensively, although they did just choke two games against Houston, who is 4-7 and not in second place. Second place is actually the Angels, but that's not going to hold for very long. They're actually technically tied for first at 6-4, but this is, again, one of those we played an easy schedule type of a thing. They couldn't even win that series against Boston at home, like I talked about. So I don't think there's anything there in terms of a potential breakout season. I do think that Mike Trout is going to have one of his better seasons, which is a really high standard considering how good he's been for how long it's been. But he's looking like vintage Mike Trout, like an MVP type season. And there is a little bit of a void there that he could fill considering Ohtani has moved to the NL, and that's, you know, two of the last, what, five MVP winners. So he could definitely take that home this year, you know, if things go his way and if he can stay healthy. But then you have Seattle and Houston, both at 4-7. Like I said, Houston taking the last two of that series against the Rangers, looking better. Ronel Blanco pitched the first no-hitter of the league in his first start, and then also pitched six no-hit innings against the Rangers a week after before giving up a hit. Or it might have been five no-hit innings. I know he gave up a hit either in the sixth or the seventh, but just ridiculous. He started out the season with at least 14 straight no-hit innings. And then Seattle, they have good pitching, but they haven't pitched well to start the season. A lot of that was bad luck if you looked at some of the things that happened in that Guardian series, but they do need to get their offense on track, which it just hasn't been so far, only averaging 3 runs per game. That's really bad. And then you have the A's, who are 3-7, and we're not even calling them Oakland anymore because their official name is going to be the A's from now on. So congratulations to the A's for playing in a AAA stadium next season with their AAA team.
I hadn't seen that little tidbit. Interesting. All right, let's move our attention to the National League, starting in the East.
Well, the National League is exactly how you would expect it to be in two of the divisions, and the other division is just upside down. But you have the Braves, of course, at the top of the NL East at 6-3. Nothing much to say there. They're near the top of the league in runs scored. It's about exactly what you would expect. And runs per game, obviously, because, you know, the Dodgers and the Padres did play two extra games to start the season. And actually, the Dodgers have played four more games than the Braves. I don't know how that happened. But anyway, Braves have played well to start the season. They're going to keep playing well. They just need their pitchers to step it up a little bit to become as dominant as they were last year. Then you have Philly. They're 5-5 to start the season. Some struggles on this roster. Nick Castellanos has not had a great season to start at all. And overall, their pitching staff has been inconsistent. So a 5-5 start, it is what it is. The rest of this division, though, is so weak that Philly should be fine making the postseason. And speaking of the weakness of this division, you have the Mets, who are 4-6. They took forever to get on the board with a win. I think they were actually, yeah, the last two teams without a win in the league were both in this division, the Mets being one of them, and the other one we'll talk about in a second. But Washington, also 4-6. I guess that's on expectation for them. They're not supposed to be terrible. They're not supposed to be good. They're not supposed to be average. They're supposed to be somewhat below average, somewhere in the below average to bad range. I don't really know how to quantify that, but they're somewhere there. They've played like it so far, and they're 4-6 as a result. And then you have Miami. This team just does not stop giving up runs. 72 runs allowed in 11 games. They're giving up almost 7 runs a game. It's just, they've just been horrible. And they and the Mets were the last two teams that were winless. And they continued it for a long, long time. The Marlins ended up 0-8 before they got their first win. Just bad to start the season. But then I'll move on to the Central. where all of the teams have actually been pretty decent. Pittsburgh doing exactly what they did last year. If you don't remember, they started off the season 21-8 and ended up 10 games under 500. But they are 9-2 to start the season again. This time it actually might be a little more sustainable. This roster is a little bit better. They've actually brought their prospects up and they are also healthy. O'Neill Cruz is playing. Cabrian Hayes is playing. Jacob Jones, or Jared Jones, excuse me, has come up and he's been really good. Paul Skeens will come up eventually, maybe this season. I don't know. But they have some really good young pitchers. They have some really good young talent overall. And it's starting to show up on the field and they are 9-2 as a result. Milwaukee, despite blowing everything up, also has really good young talent. Some of them that they got in trade, some of them that they just already had in their organization. They have some really good top end prospects. And they are 6-3 as a result of all those guys showing up. Good start to the season for them. Cincinnati is 6-4, and the Cubs are 6-4. The Cubs getting their big series win over the weekend against the Dodgers, but then following that up by blowing a massive lead against the Padres, which not something you should be doing. But look, the Cubs, they played Windy City Wind Ball against the Dodgers and, you know, some crazy weather conditions throughout that series. But the Cubs ended up with the series victory. They're happy about that. And also their roster does look pretty good. Michael Busch has been pretty good to start the season after he's finally getting a major league or an extended opportunity in the major leagues after the Dodgers had him up. You know, it's a pinch hitter, maybe filling in for an injured guy here or there. He's gotten a fresh start and he's made the most of it. And then the Reds are just doing what the Reds do. Decent, okay pitching, average pitching, I don't know. And good offense, what you'd expect from a lot of those young prospects that they have that can hit, although Matt McClain being out is going to hurt them long term. Then you have the Cardinals at 5-6 at the bottom of the division. It's looking like they actually could end this division in last. I mean, I still think that they're probably better than Milwaukee, probably better than Cincinnati, but we'll just have to see as the season goes on. And then finally in the West, you have the Dodgers who are 9-4. It's really weird to say that a 9-4 team has looked pedestrian, but considering what this roster has on it, talent-wise, they have looked pedestrian. The Dodgers still have to wait to get some pitchers back. Walker Buehler still pitching in AAA. Clayton Kershaw still not pitching at all. Dustin May still not pitching at all. Tony Gonsolin still not pitching at all. Some of those guys won't pitch this season, of course, or won't pitch until super late at best. Brewster Graterol will come back later. So the Dodgers still are getting pieces back somehow, and they have this roster. Yamamoto has recovered from his first game jitters and has looked a lot better since then. Tyler Glasnow has been great. And James Paxton has looked even okay for the Dodgers. So they do have, it looks like the pitching staff has actually kind of figured itself out. And Walker Buehler is going to kick somebody out of the rotation, but it's looking like it won't be one of the vets. And then you have the Padres in second. I don't know how that happened, but they're 6-7, 3 games back of the Dodgers. This team is exactly what it was last year. They for some reason can't win certain close games. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. The talent is everywhere. Maybe the pitching staff not as great as it was last year, but Yu Darvish has had a better year than he's had in the past, or recently at least. So he's getting better. They're playing a little bit better. Then you have Arizona and San Francisco, who are both 4-7. San Francisco took the weekend series from the Padres, but came into that series limping a little bit. So as a result, they're still way under 500. But Jung Hoo Lee has been good to start the season, and we'll look to see more signs of improvement from him and some other signs on the roster. But then you have Arizona. They're 4-7 so far. I mean, they played the Braves. It is what it is. They were 4-4 going into that series. Jordan Montgomery hasn't pitched for them yet. I think they'll be fine long term, and I still think they're the second best team in this division. But they have lost 5 in a row, which isn't great. And then finally, you have the Rockies, who are the only other team other than the White Sox to be eliminated, according to FanGraphs, already, just 10 games into the season. So a pretty bad team there. They still can't pitch. Still should be hitting a lot better considering they play in Coors, but they don't. Same old for the Rockies. Same old for the NL West.
All right, that wraps up our look at Major League Baseball for the week. Let's turn our attention to college basketball with a review of both the women's and the men's Final Four action. Let's start with the women's Final Four.
Well, I would say that both of these Final Fours were exciting, but also unsurprising. A lot of these games ended up with not close scores, but they were closer at the beginning. Number one, South Carolina beat number three, NC State, 78-59. But NC State and South Carolina, I believe they were at least
close at the half. They might have been tied. I don't remember if it was tied or if it was a 1 or 2 point game. But it was a really, really close game early. And then South Carolina just came out and showed their dominance. They showed why they're the number one team. They showed why they were 36-0 heading into the game. And that was just kind of the end of it, which was actually a similar theme that I'll get to in a second. But then number one, Iowa beat number three, UConn, 71-69. That was the only time UConn was going to be losing this week. I won't even say there was a controversial call at the end of this game because it wasn't controversial. It was very, very obvious if you saw the right angle that it was a moving screen. And Caitlin Clark, she was held down for a decent portion of this game by Nika Mule and the UConn defense overall. But then at the end of the game, she was able to get it going a little bit more and helped Iowa get back into it as UConn had held the lead for a long portion of the game. But then Iowa was able to pull it away in the end. And then in the championship game, number one, South Carolina beat number one, Iowa, 87-75. It's not very often that a 37-0 team can get revenge, but the last team to beat South Carolina was Iowa. So this was a revenge game for South Carolina. They remembered the sting of losing last year. Obviously not, obviously the freshmen don't, but you know, the rest of the roster did. And they were on a mission to beat Iowa as a result. They did so 87-75, and that allowed South Carolina to claim a 38-0 undefeated season for the national championship, their third and second in the last 3 years. And look, it was the best season for growing women's college basketball ever, just by such a wide margin. I hope that it continues with WNBA viewership, although that schedule is just so oddly timed that I don't know if it'll have as much momentum. But, you know, I think there will still be people who watch these stars and have now seen them in college the whole time that will actually want to watch them in the WNBA because they have recognizable names. And I'd argue they have more stars in the men's game at this point. More stars that are actually going to play in the end that are going to play in the professionals. There are plenty of great college players in men's college basketball, but a lot of them are big men, so they're boring to watch and they won't be making the NBA because of the modern game. This Final Four was amazing. Just really, really fun to watch. The tournament overall was pretty great on the women's side as well. I would argue a lot more exciting than the men's tournament, which I'll now turn to, where number one Purdue beat number 11 NC State 63-50. This might have been the worst matchup on paper that NC State could have drawn. I really have there's really no other way to draw it up. They're not deep with their big men. Edie's playing 40 minutes a game. DJ Burns is only playing like 20 to 25. And if he couldn't get it going and just either somehow get Edie into foul trouble, which he just doesn't get into ever, or he could just score over Edie and kind of wear him out on the defensive end so that he couldn't do as much on the offensive end, that was kind of NC State's only hope. And instead, it was DJ Burns who, A, got into foul trouble, and B, got tired on the defensive end and couldn't really hold Edie down. So as a result, Purdue able to walk away with that victory, really, really pulled that game away at the end. NC State was keeping it close for a while, but it really felt like Purdue was controlling it the whole time, playing at a pace that, you know, maybe not their preferred pace, but they're used to it playing in the Big Ten, playing at kind of a slower pace with another team that's big men oriented, and no one on NC State's bench could come off the bench and stop Purdue. So other than DJ Horn coming out and exploiting Purdue's drop coverage on the screen on pick and rolls, NC State really didn't have an answer for Purdue. And as a result, Purdue advanced to the championship game. Then you had number one UConn who beat number four Alabama 86-72. I think Alabama by far was they deserve the most credit for their tournament run. I think NC State's run obviously is just, you know, a miraculous, it's one of the Cinderella runs. It is what it is. But Alabama all year long has been up there, but has not kind of cemented itself as one of the top teams. This run did. I mean, this was something that they were the only team that really competed with UConn at all in the entire tournament. Illinois was as close at the half as Alabama was, but then Illinois gave up a 30-0 run. At least Alabama, they didn't give up a 30-0 run. UConn definitely did, you know, flex its muscles at the end of the game, have a dominant run to make this a double-digit victory, as they always end up with. But Alabama really did stay close for most of this game, and it just kind of got away, you know, in the 6 minutes left to 3 minutes left range. But UConn you know, this team is just dominant, and I'll talk about the championship game now. They beat Purdue 75-60. Everybody knows that. Also, really an unsurprising result. Both teams, one historically, not historically dominant, one undefeated team on the women's side wins it all. And then a historically dominant UConn team wins it all. If you couldn't see this championship coming from a mile away, you just didn't watch basketball this season. I've talked about this so many times on this podcast. I've talked about this so many times off this podcast. I've never seen a team execute offense as well as UConn does. And there was no other team in the country that had that level of execution on offense that wasn't just dependent on an individual player going turbo, going turbo nuclear mode. I mean, that includes Purdue. I think that when Zach Edey is just getting the ball and scoring, obviously this team can be really, really effective, but they still need guys around him to play well. UConn's not reliant on one guy. They really, really spread the ball around. They share the wealth. Edey had 37 points in this game, and UConn won by 15. I mean, it should be impossible to give up almost 40 points on 60% shooting to any player and still win the game, but that was their mentality. They said, let's let Edey do his damage inside, and as long as Klingon avoids foul trouble, can stay on the floor himself, we're going to win this game with our guards because we have better size, we have better talent, we have better athleticism. It was a great game plan by Dan Hurley. It was a great, great game plan all season by Dan Hurley. And really, this UConn team is just a masterclass of offensive execution paired with defensive intensity that's just enough to drag its team over the edge. And it's not like UConn was a bad defensive team or anything. I'm just saying that their offense is clearly what has made this team, which is interesting because UConn in the past has been more of a defensive team. But this year, they turned it up on the offensive end. They decided to recruit some shooters, and it worked perfectly. This roster is it's just ridiculous. There's a huge talent gap in this game, and credit to Purdue for even making it here and also getting to this game. But look, no one was beating UConn. That was the very first thing I did with my bracket is pick UConn, 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 UConn all the way until the end. And that is exactly what happened. There's a reason why 24% of people picked them. I would argue best team I've seen in my life. The only team that ever that even comes close is that Villanova team that literally has three of the New York Knicks starting five currently. That's the only other team that comes remotely near it because they also won every game in the tournament by double digits. So for me, in my lifetime, it's this UConn team and then that Villanova team. I believe that was 2019 or maybe 2018. But other than that, I can't see even another team in my lifetime that you could even come close to arguing was better. And they deserve the repeat more than anybody else ever has.
Yeah, and I wouldn't call it dragging them across the finish line. To your point, extremely dominant, not only this year and last year. They talk about records in sports that may never be broken. I don't want to say never, but UConn has now won 12 straight NCAA tournament games by more than 13 points. I think the record prior to that was six. So pretty amazing run, not just this year, but also last year. And last year may have surprised a little bit of some people because they were a four seed. But agree with you. I may have seen some pretty dominant teams in my lifetime, but I'm a lot older than you. But it did remind me of that Villanova run. And the question is, how long can they keep this dynasty up? Last time anybody won three in a row, I believe, was the late 1960s, early 1970s UCLA. So we will see. I don't see the UConn train stopping anytime soon, unless maybe their coach gets lured to Kentucky. But that's a different story and probably unlikely to happen. All right, that wraps up our look at the men's and women's Final Four. It also wraps this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. Please be sure to check out our next podcast, which will be on Tuesday, April 16th, where we will once again look back at Patrick's weekend predictions, have another look at NBA action as the season starts to wind down and we head towards the play-in, and have our weekly review of MLB action. In the meantime, please be sure to check out Patrick's additional content, including his picks for next weekend's games that, as we mentioned, and as always, will be posted on Thursdays, and his Major League Baseball power rankings, which will be posted tomorrow. All of that content on our website, 4thand24.com. That's the number 4, THAND, the number 24.com. Thank you for listening.